Well, hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Tech Doctor episode. This is Robert the Tech Doctor, and along with me is my ever-present podcasting partner, Allison Hartley. How's it going today, Allison?
It is going fabulous today. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. As always, it's a pleasure to be podcasting with you again. And, you know, a couple months ago, an article came across my RSS feed about Apple accessibility. And that's not unusual for us because you and I have our radar tuned to that topic since we tend to talk about it a lot.
Just a little.
Just a little. But there were a couple things about this article that were a bit unique. First of all, the article was very cogent. It made some really interesting points about accessibility that aren't always made when we talk about Apple accessibility. And the second thing about it, which was really interesting, was that, you know, very often these articles are written by one of us, either someone who has a disability or by someone who works in the accessibility field. But this particular article was written by someone who's a very well-known mainstream writer, journalist in the Apple community, podcaster. His name is Rene Ritchie. He runs a very popular and successful website called the iMore.com site. And much to my great pleasure, Rene agreed to come on the Tech Doctor podcast and talk with us about Apple accessibility. But before we jump into the details of the article and talk about all that, Rene, please take a few moments and introduce yourself to the Tech Doctor listeners, and also tell us a little bit about what iMore.com is all about.
First, let me thank you both for having me on the show. It's an honor and a privilege, and I'm grateful for it. iMore is a website that's just dedicated to everything about Apple, from iPhones to iPads to Macs, and mostly with helping people get more out of those products. We do cover news and we do reviews and things like that, but our primary focus is just helping people, because Apple did something interesting with computers. They decided, even from the beginning, to make them more accessible in the broadest sense of the definition, to take them from the universities and the companies and put them on people's desks and make them ever easier to use, to democratize the technology. So if you go from the Apple II to the Macintosh, you know, they made it graphical and they made it a mouse and a pointer and they made it easier to use. And then again, they go to the iPhone and the iPad, so you have multi-touch and they're cheaper and you can carry them around with you. And again, they're available to more people, so that, you know, punch cards, my mom, my sister, even I, you know, they were totally inaccessible to me in those days. And I played around with the command line, but it wasn't until the GUI came across that I could actually really start using computers. And it wasn't until the iPad came along that my mother felt, and my mother, I should point out, was married to an IBM engineer for years. And she just always felt, she's a history of art and architecture professor, and she always felt that they were inaccessible to her and complicated and off-putting. And now her iPad is one of her best friends, and she's just able to use it all the time. And that idea that technology can be made available to people, that we can use it to live better lives, to do things more efficiently, and to have more fun, was always very compelling to me. And I had the chance to do that with a place like iMore. I leapt at it.
Absolutely. And iMore is very accessible for those of us who are blind,
Yes. Thanks
to the voiceover technology on the Mac and iOS. And so that's, of course, the website itself. But there are also a couple of iOS apps for iMore. There's a forums app, and there's also a regular iMore news app, which are completely accessible with voiceover. And I was just a little bit curious, because that's the way I tend to read a lot of stuff on iMore. Do the apps offer basically the same information that's available on the website?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to confess, like most people, we didn't actually design them with accessibility in mind. We were lucky in that we used the default controllers that Apple provided. In the case of the forums, it's using the Tapetalk engine, which is a really well-known forum encapsulating engine. And for the iMore app, it's using a lot of the default controls from iOS 7. And if you do that, if you don't want to remake everything from scratch, Apple builds, you know, the speak selection and the voiceover technology right into it. So we sort of got lucky. And it wasn't until we had Doug Russell on the Iterate podcast. And back then he was doing work on accessibility in general. Now he's part of Apple's accessibility group. And we had Natalia Berdus on Debug, who was speaking at WWDC about inclusivity, that we really stopped and thought about it in, you know, in how we could make it more accessible. And we were delighted to find that most of the heavy lifting had already been done.
Well, that's one of the beautiful things about Apple accessibility, honestly, is that it's built into the operating systems from the ground up. And if you follow their guidelines, and as you said, use standard controls, you have a lot of the work done for you when you develop an app or when you create a website, things like that.
Yeah, and that's tremendously important because making accessibility, as silly as it sounds, making accessibility accessible, I think is tremendously important because developing an app is non-trivial. And some people skimp on design, some people skimp on marketing. And unfortunately, accessibility is an area that first suffers from lack of awareness, but also suffers from being one of the things that people put to the side and say they'll do next time. And Apple has made it, you know, again, if you stick to those standard controls, has made it very easy not to have to do that. They've made making it included in your app from the beginning a very attainable goal.
Yeah, and that's something that's brand new for the world of accessibility for a mainstream company to do that. And we're going to dig in and talk a little more about some of those things in the moment. Your article that you came out with in June is called Apple and Accessibility, Pushing Back Against Unacceptable Realities. It's a very interesting title. And Allison, if you will, kick off this discussion and help us get started on talking about this article.
Well, sure. You know, Renee, your article really caught the attention of really everybody, but especially those of us in the blindness community and the blind iOS community. One of the things that you mentioned in the beginning of the article was that not a lot of people really think about accessibility, you know, cognizantly. I'm curious to know what actually got you thinking along the lines of accessibility to the point where you actually felt inspired to write an article about it.
We sort of ramped up to it slowly. And for me, the pivotal point, at least, was having Doug Russell on Iterate because he is so good at talking about how important accessibility is. And then when I went to WWDC, I went to Apple's accessibility lab and spoke to some of the people there and tried to find out more about what they were doing. And then one of our priorities became to make sure that we emphasize it. So we built an accessibility section on iMore. There's an entire hub there now and created a forum there for people to discuss accessibility and inclusivity. And it was sort of on the back burner. It was one of several things that I had to do. And fall is always crazy around iOS time, so it's difficult to almost, you know, assign your points to where you think you can make the most difference. But then I saw Tim Cook, Apple's CEO. A couple of things happened with him. One is he was at a shareholders meeting and he was being given a hard time by a think tank group saying that basically he was wasting shareholder money by promoting the environment and promoting accessibility. And it was the most fired up I've ever seen Tim Cook, who's almost always icy cold when, yeah, you know, he's congenial, but he's not fiery like Steve Jobs was. And he basically said, "We're doing this. And if you don't like it, you can just get out of the stock right now."
Yep. I remember that.
And that it was that important to him, the CEO of a major company. And, you know, a lot of companies, Microsoft, they all do great things for accessibility, but that someone at the very top was saying that this was important and it was important beyond any single profit or loss line item was hugely important. And then the title of that article comes from a quote he gave when he was talking at Auburn University. He was honored by them. And he was talking about the importance of accessibility to Apple. And he was saying how hard a job it is to do. And And then unacceptable reality thing was what he tasked Apple's engineers to accomplish. He said, "Yes, we know it's difficult, but it is so important that we are going to make sure we do it right." And again, I figured that if it was starting from the top down there, I mean, it was the least that we could do to try and give it more attention or help out in any way we can to give it more attention.
Well, starting from the top down is really an important idea. And it's something that we have never seen before in the field of accessibility. You know, before Apple came along with its accessibility initiative, accessibility was something that was always bolted on to a Windows machine, if a blind person wanted access to Windows or to the Symbian mobile operating system, you had to purchase a third-party screen reading app that would oftentimes cost you two or three times the cost of the actual device itself, install that on top of the operating system, and hope that it was able to give you sufficient information about what was on the screen to make accessibility work for you so you could use the applications. But Apple completely came along and turned that paradigm or that model on its head. And they really kind of did three things. You know, one of them is, as we've already said, they built accessibility into the operating system as opposed to bolting it on. They went ahead and made accessibility free of charge in the sense that you don't pay extra for Apple accessibility, which was huge in this community. And third, they started touting accessibility as being part of the major fabric or framework of what Apple is all about, which is what you were just alluding to. And one of the things that you do in your article is you suggest that accessibility is not only good for those of us who need it because we have a disability, but it's good for the Apple community as a whole. And I wonder if you would just address that a little bit and say what your thinking is about that. How is it good for everybody?
Just to go inside Apple for a second, they have groups of people who are focused on doing several things. And they have, for example, they have a performance group who wants to make sure that battery life is great and that apps are snappy and responsive. And they have a security group who wants to make sure that things are safe and your privacy is protected. And they have an accessibility group whose only job it is to go through Apple software and make sure it's as accessible as possible. And I think the reason for that is the same as the reason for my statement is when you expand accessibility into inclusivity and you start to sweat those details, it makes it better for everyone. It makes it better. For example, I have a 5-year-old godson, and since he was 2 years old, he was using an iPad. There is no way he could have used any other computer in the world. I could have given him my old Trio phone or one of my early Android phones, and the most he could do was get frustrated and throw it at my head. But he could unlock an iPad. He could start his reading programs. He could do it. My grandmother, she was 90 years old, and we gave her an iPad and synced photos with it, and she could pick it up and open it and go through those photographs. And she'd never used a computer in her entire life. It just was not part of her experience. And technologies that allow anyone access to a computer, that democratize that technology, to repeat that phrase, makes it better for everyone. It means any app that I pick up is also more accessible. It's more intuitive. I don't have to struggle or feel alienated or feel stupid trying to use it. They do everything they can to make sure that when I swipe, it does what I expect it to do. When I see a button and I push it, I go where I expect to go. And that just takes all the stress out of an application. So when Apple makes it, you know, work better with people with hearing difficulties or people with motor function challenges or people who have visual impairments, all of that goes towards the core experience of the application. And it means anyone on that spectrum, you know, maybe you have glasses and you're just not wearing them and you reach for your phone bleary-eyed in the morning, or, you know, maybe there's a lot of loud music around and you're trying to talk to Siri because, you know, it's too dark for you to type, or whatever the situation is. It just means that those same assistive technologies are there to assist everyone when they need them.
To give an example of that, I actually have a colleague who is fully sighted, but she wanted to be able to read her iBooks in the car because mm-hmm. she commutes a rather long way to and from work. So I actually got her set up with VoiceOver, and I taught her how to do the triple click home function to turn it off and on, and she can actually use VoiceOver now to read her iBooks while she's in the car.
It sounds silly, but I know a lot of designers who use the triple click to zoom to check every pixel on the icons or every yeah. button on the layout that they're working on.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Renee, is the reason that Apple is so far ahead of Google and Amazon and Microsoft when it comes to really seriously incorporating accessibility? I mean, these other companies seem to be working on it. They're trying, but if we're honest,
it's slow though. Yeah.
It's slow and it's behind, and there just isn't, you don't hear the CEOs of those companies getting up talking about accessibility. Why is Apple different in that regard, do you think?
I think there's Apple as a company is fundamentally different. And one of the advantages that we get from the specific differences, it's a benefit of the way that Apple's culture is set up. And I don't want to take away from other companies because, you know, Google Voice for some people is tremendous. And Microsoft has done a lot of interesting things with reading and assistive technologies. But they always feel more fragmented, like one group of people or one implementation and not part of a cohesive whole planned strategy. Where Apple is a large company, but they're run like a series of small startups. They're run like a very small, very hungry, very focused company. And that means when they pick something to be important to them, whether it's making multi-touch computers or whether it's, you know, making music better, anything that they choose to work on, they can put a tremendous amount of force of will behind it. And I think, you know, environment is one of the things they've chosen to focus on. And accessibility is one of the things they've chosen to focus on. And because of their structure, it doesn't matter if, you know, third level down inner management system B decides that his ratings matrix will be negatively affected if he takes the time to implement this function. It just means we want this done. These are the resources to do it. Make sure it's ready to ship.
Well, your point is a really excellent one about the fact that Apple has the resources, has the engineering talent. I mean, who would have ever thought that they could take a flat piece of glass like an iPhone and make it usable by a blind person?
Yeah.
That's a step that I never imagined they would take, but they have the resources, the tools, the talent to make that happen, and maybe more importantly, the will to do it.
I think it's the will that's really key there, because Apple, and people always get shocked when they hear this, but Apple is incredibly resource constrained. They do not have enough engineers to do what they want to do. And part of that is because there's fierce competition for engineers from Facebook, from Google, and from startup companies where you can get large amounts of stock and, you know, maybe get bought out by another big company quickly. And also because they insist that most of their people work in Cupertino, California, and there'll always be a limit of the amount of people who are willing to move there to work. So Apple, there are things that Apple has to make hard choices about. They have a limited amount of people they can apply to it. And I think it is that force of will and that importance that has them devoting these resources to accessibility when there are so many other things that they're struggling to get done.
We're very fortunate that they made that choice. It certainly has changed my life.
And mine. I can think of about four devices that I was thinking about buying prior to getting my iPhone that would have run me into the thousands, possibly even tens of thousands of dollars that have been completely replaced by my little $400 64 gig iPhone. So yeah. That alone is just amazing.
I remember being at WWDC several, and I forget exactly which year it was, but the first year that they introduced FaceTime, they ended the commercial with people using sign language at the end. And when they first introduced Siri, they ended the commercial with someone sending and receiving messages using Siri. And those moments, you could feel it in the audience. As cool as technology was, those were the moments that made it human. And I think that focus on humanity is what allows them to get a lot of this stuff done.
It is a priority for Apple to make a customer experience that people won't forget, even starting with the way the products are placed in the box. You open the box, it jumps out at you. I mean, it's truly a unique approach to selling devices.
It's that old Steve Jobs painting the back of the fence analogy that in his biography was credited to his father. When his father was doing that, and he said, "Why? No one's going to know." And he said, "I'll know." And that filtered down to Steve Jobs being very concerned about everything from the layout internally of the chipsets to the packaging to every part of the experience. And I think, you know, it's been said before that Steve Jobs' greatest product was Apple itself. He built a culture there where people like Tim Cook, who are brilliant, but brilliant in a very different way than Steve Jobs, picked up those things that were best about him and those details that were, you know, important to him. And you have designers like Johnny Ive and everyone on the human interface and interaction team, all the way on down to the people in the program offices building these features who care about those little details and think that they are just as important as, you know, the size of the screen or the speed of the radio.
You mentioned painting the fence in your article. Obviously, it's something that resonates with you personally, and you have also been painting the back of the fence on iMore with the starting the disability forums and the discussions and all that. And tell us a little bit more about that, if you will. What are you hoping for there? How would you like people to make use of what's there. What's it going to be as far as disability and IMOR is concerned?
So one of the things that I wanted to be very careful was not to hijack anyone's agenda. I wanted to try and help bring attention to it, but I didn't want to by any means suggest that, you know, I knew enough about these problems to speak about them with experience and with any particular insight. So we got everything set up and we did the stuff that we know how to do really well, which is create those forms and create those hubs and do, you know, very basic level explanations of how the what the features are and how they work, so that anybody who's brand new to an iPhone or an iPad can go there and just, you know, if they don't know that Apple can do certain things with hearing aids, or they don't know about the motor controls or the switch mechanisms, they can go there and just find out that they exist and how to turn them on and how to begin using them. But the second phase, and we started it now with people like Steve Aquino, is to get people involved in the assistive technologies and accessibility and inclusivity space to contribute articles about what those technologies not just mean for them, but have allowed them to accomplish. And not strictly in the inspirational sense or even the evangelism sense, but in terms of telling people who might have these difficulties what the specific tools are and methods are and experiences are, so that they can get the same sort of benefits from them.
So if somebody is interested in contributing an article, would the best bet be to post in the forum? Would they contact you? What would be the best means of accomplishing that?
I mean, both are great. I started posting in the forums how I got involved with iMOR to begin with. Actually, back before there was iMOR, I was doing that in the Trio Central forums when that was still a device. So that's always great, because it means that there will never be enough column inches to record everyone's experience. It's just a factor of volume versus, you know, publication possibilities. But the thing I love about forums is that they give everybody a voice. And when it's in one place and everyone knows where to find it, it means that everyone who's interested in that stuff will see and hear and experience the stuff that you're sharing. So I'm a huge fan of those. But also, people can email me, renee@imore.com, at any time. And we want to get, you know, as wide a range of experiences as possible there.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm hoping that a lot of Tech Doctor listeners might decide to contribute something there, because I think it's the real way that we keep this accessibility moving forward. You talked in your article about, you know, in a sense, we can all do more. We can all help to make Apple and all other products more accessible if we work on it and talk about it and write about it and push on it a bit. And it sounds like you at iMOR are really committed to that idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things you'd be surprised at how, you know, Apple is this huge company, but it's impossible for any person or any company to think of everything. And that applies specifically to use cases too. For example, you might think that VoiceOver covers everything, but there might be a use case where it doesn't. So if Apple doesn't know about that, they won't develop speak selection, to use a current example, or they might not do the switch controls because they think something else covers that. So the more experiences people share, not only does it inform, you know, maybe Apple's future product directions, but somebody who has a specific problem who's discounted that said that won't work for me, chances are someone else has had that same problem and has come up with a workaround or has found an app or an accessory or something else that might fill in whatever gaps remain, or just thought about using them in a way that no one else, at least publicly, has thought about doing it again. So the more people you have there, the more diverse the thinking and the experiences you have there, the better chance you can find something that'll help you.
Well, that's a great way to put it, because Apple accessibility, as great as it is, isn't perfect. It's an ever-moving target.
Oh, yeah.
And there are always things that can be improved upon or things that can be done. You know, some Apple critics have said things like, well, you know, you better be careful being excited about Apple accessibility, because it could just go away one day. I personally doubt that Apple will ever stop supporting accessibility, because it's become such a part of their fabric. But What do you think about that, Renee, and about the future of accessibility? I mean, is there some huge graphical interface going to come along that's going to, you know, wipe out the possibilities for VoiceOver to read what's on the screen? Or are you worried about accessibility going away?
Out of all the myriad universes in this multiverse, there is one in which Apple doesn't even make iPhones. So, you know, if you go by that logic, it's possible that Apple will stop producing devices one day. And, you know, it's certainly true. Apple could go out of business. There's a lot of scary possibilities out there, but I don't think they're likely. I think it's always important to distinguish between what's possible and what's likely. And given Apple's past behavior, their future behavior seems to be one that is ever increasingly accessible. And they're, you know, they don't do everything right. There's still no Siri on Mac, for example. So people who can use Siri to do all sorts of fantastic things on iOS devices don't have that same ability if they want to use Macs. And that's something that I hope Apple addresses. And, you know, maybe there are limitations with microphone technology or licensing agreements that have made that take longer. But that just means, you know, talking about it more is increasingly helpful.
Yeah, and maybe there are limitations, you know, on how they're going to work it all out so that when you talk to Siri on your Mac, your iPhone doesn't wake up and start doing things in your iPad. And so it's an interesting problem to be working on, I think.
It is, and Siri in general, I mean, people have wanted a Siri API for a long time, and all of these things sound wonderful, but I always think you got to start thinking of the repercussions. So, for example, if I have Fantastical and Calendar installed on my iPhone, and in a world with a Siri API, if I say, add this event, how does Calendar know to let Fantastical handle it? Or if I have three calendar apps, there's all sorts of problems with collision. And Apple usually takes their time. Like, it took a year to get a Touch ID API, but they did it in an incredibly intelligent and incredibly secure way so that they don't expose my biometric data. And I think Siri APIs, if they go that direction, will be equally well thought out. And to your previous question, I think that accessibility can never revert because the technologies that the main goal of Apple is to make computing more accessible, period. And people who have impairments, you know, absolutely are part of that. But as they move to making it, the iPhone sells better than any computer Apple's ever made because it is more accessible to more people than any computer they've ever made. And they're only going to want to ever do more of that. They're only going to want to sell more devices. And one day, you know, Siri didn't replace the graphical user interface. It sits adjacent to it. And Siri by itself, having natural language and having sequential inference, is such an enabling technology. But that's the benefit of a technology that enables everyone. And if we continue to the absurd science fiction future where we control everything with our minds, that's even more accessible than any sort of physical technology today. So I think the future in that regards is fairly safe for everybody.
Yeah, the future in terms of accessibility implications, especially going forward into iOS 8 and Yosemite, are really, really exciting to me, particularly in the areas of HomeKit and HealthKit, being able to accessibly control various devices and items in my home is something that I've often dreamed about, but not ever really had the opportunity to do as a blind person. And then also being able to do things like securely transmit health information to my doctor, being able to go into my doctor's office and not get handed the inaccessible clipboard and have somebody, you know, sitting there collecting my medical information. I basically would have to tell them everything on the forms, which of course is a violation of privacy. I think HealthKit really has an opportunity to make some changes in that arena for everybody as well.
Yeah, and again, that shows how what benefits the most people benefits everybody. You have something like HomeKit, which will allow anybody, you know, to have lights that are controlled or garage doors, but it enables someone who finds it difficult to control those things to say, for example, good night, Siri, and know that that garage door is locking and those lights are off,
yeah,
or have verify that that stove is turned off, or just walk into a store one day and all the technology available on your iPhone can be used for commerce. You don't have to worry about mixing up the numbers on a bill that you give somebody and they're not telling you, or what they're doing with your credit card when you pass it to them. Because you know how to control your device. You have control of that device. And that trust that you have is just extended to the commerce process. And all
right.
of that, again, is accessible for everyone, and as well as people with special needs.
We don't think much about the fact that we are at the infancy of all this, and there yeah. is so much exciting to come. We have to really buckle in, strap in, and hang on for the ride because
yeah.
we're just getting started.
Yeah, and it's not, I mean, it sounds fantastic, and there will be risks and rewards. Like for some people, the HealthKit stuff, they're not going to want to trust an Apple device with their health information. For example, Google Now, some people, they don't want to trust Google with their web history, so that gets turned off. So there's all sorts of implications. It's not it's not a uniquely rosy future. It's one that we'll all have to make informed adult decisions about. But if you do trust in the technology and you do find it of value, it will be there for you, which is something that it wasn't in the past.
I for one, welcome our friendly robot overlords.
there are going to be some huge challenges getting insurance companies to allow self-driving cars on the road and you know, to take advantage of all the health information and to let the drones land with their Amazon packages. Yes. Right? I mean it's truly going to be a challenging and exciting time.
It's going to be in a lot of ways, too. I mean, I think everybody likes the idea of self-driving cars as long as it's everyone else who's being driven in those cars. And I forget where it was posited this week, but there was an article saying you're in a self-driving car and a kid runs across the road and the car's only choice is to hit the kid or to crash you into the side of the road. In all of those things, you know, humans will make different decisions there, but that has to be programmatically described into a car. Or if a drone crashes and hits somebody, you know, that's a different use case than a driver delivering a van going to a door. And all of these are areas of ethics and morality that we've never had to address before, let alone involving automated objects in the decision-making process. So that future becomes even more complicated.
But the exciting thing, even with all of the challenges and all the conflict and the issues that will come up for sure, is that Apple has demonstrated clearly that people who have disabilities can and will, if given the opportunity, fully participate in what's going on in our society and make use of our technology. And it can only help the horrendous problem that we have of unemployment in the disability community and a lack of education. It's changing, literally, I think, what it means in our society to have a disability. Maybe that's a little bit far-reaching, but it's a very exciting thing to think about.
I think it absolutely is. And I think, again, it goes in so many – it's such a virtuous cycle. A technology that's invented like FaceTime or Siri for everybody has incredible implications to people in the assistive technologies field, or a technology like guided access, which is developed for accessibility, ends up finding incredible usage in kiosks or in museums. And things like iBeacons, which are coming up, will help people in stores, you know, sell things better, but they'll also help someone who's visually impaired move through a national park. And all of these things just make our lives better in so many ways beyond what, you know, maybe their initial design was intended for.
A huge challenge for people with blindness and visual impairment has been indoor navigation. Yes. GPS has done a nice job of giving us good information when we're outside, but inside a mall or some other facility, locating a particular store, a particular place, or a particular hotel room is truly a challenge. And I'm pretty convinced that the iBeacon or some technology like it is going to really help with indoor navigation. And that's an application of it that most people don't even really give much thought to.
They don't, but it's easy to make it really understandable to them when you say, you know, you're going to an office for your job interview for the first time. It's a giant building and you have no idea where you have to be, because now you've made an accessibility problem for them. And the same technology that's going to take them to the office for their job interview when they are stressed, when they might be running late, when they have no idea how to even approach that building, is the same thing that'll let someone walk through something like a park with a visual impairment.
I don't know how many times I've been to my doctor's office with my sighted wife, and we'll get there and she'll say, now, gosh, is it on the third floor or the fifth floor? And the technology can really help with that, because people just don't always remember those kinds of things.
It's the same way, you know, GPS helps everybody. And Apple's an interesting company. I tend to like Apple because I feel that our interests are aligned. That it's a very simple transaction. I give them money, they give me a shiny box that does amazing things, and there's no ulterior motives. And some people legitimately say they want Apple to do more. For example, they'd like Siri to do all the predictive stuff that Google Now does. But in order for Google Now to do the predictive stuff, they have to have much, much greater access to your email, to your location, to your web history, to all these things. And Apple can absolutely do that. They have a huge server infrastructure, but they've made a conscious choice of not wanting to intermingle their user data on their servers. And it means that there's less functionality presented to the end user, but it also means that the functionality that is presented is not very invasive. And we have the choice. If we want more of that kind of stuff, we can go with Google Now. They even have Google Now on iOS, and it'll probably be more powerful when iOS 8 comes across with extensions, because it can be more fully integrated. But if you don't want those things, but you still want natural language and the other things, you can choose to go with Siri. And I think that creates a nice sort of scaled approach to how much help or how much information we want to share.
Well, it's a very thought-through approach. And I love the fact that Apple didn't do extensions until they could do them in a way that still protects our data and still keeps apps from interfering with one another. I mean, it sort of keeps the sandboxing in place, or but the best parts of sandboxing and reduces some of the inconveniences of it. So, I mean, it's very thought through, and I love that about Apple.
It's interesting to watch both Apple and Google, because people will say, you know, Apple doesn't have this functionality, or Google doesn't have this user experience. And those things are incredibly hard, and we don't appreciate how hard they are until we see that it took Apple until two or three years ago, they ported XPC, which is their cross communications protocol, over. And then it took them several years to build that out until we could have extensibility. And Google was built with a very open architecture, but their user experience wasn't very good. And it's taken them until Android L to start actually having a cohesive interaction model on their phones. So they both basically started from different ends of the spectrum and had to work their way back to the middle.
They did. And I'm hopeful that Android will continue to move in the direction. It's so funny to me that Android accessibility is gradually, as it moves along, adding more and more iOS-like accessibility gestures to make Android more easily usable by a blind person, for example. And when they first started out with it, I mean, it was really, there were some very strange gestures to get information.
I wanted to throw my Nexus 7 at the wall.
Yeah, to get information off the screen. It did make you want to throw it against the wall. It's been so much fun talking with you, Renee. We've kind of covered a lot of things here in a hurry about accessibility, and we don't want to take up more of your busy day. But I do want to ask you, before you go, is there anything that you would like to leave the Tech Doctor listeners with, any information or thoughts that maybe you would like to kind of bring this to a close on here?
Well, I would just like, just as a follow-up to what we were just talking about, I think it's hugely important that Google and Android get accessibility as well as they can, because people can choose to use Apple products, but increasingly Android is just going to be part of everyday life. It's going to be like embedded Linux. It's going to be it's going to replace Microsoft as the barely debugged stack of drivers that everything from washing machines to refrigerators to television sets run. And if they don't get their accessibility act together before that stuff becomes increasingly common, then a lot of people are going to be stuck with legacy devices that they don't change very often, that are running computer systems that don't make it very easy to use. So my hope is that accessibility becomes a competitive feature, the way that, you know, a lot of the specs are today, processor speed or screen size, and that people compete heavily on that. Because then if you do get that new DVD player, it's not a horrendous experience the way it is today, or that television set or that, you know, stove and all this stuff that's going to be smart. When we have this Internet of Things, it'll be smart and it will be inclusive.
I hope that your hope becomes a reality, because that's exactly what we need. And right now, the huge fragmentation with a lot of these operating systems is a very big problem for accessibility. Yeah. A lot of the devices won't even run the latest versions that are likely to be more accessible, or there are problems with just making it work with your model of TV or your model of washing machine or whatever. I mean, it's a big problem that no one seems to quite have a handle on at this point.
Which is why I hope things like CarPlay, Apple's very different. Apple doesn't manufacture all these things, and they don't share their software. But what they do is very carefully approach industries. And now with things like HomeKit and CarPlay and AirPlay, I think at least if we have that layer of interoperability and we choose to use Apple products, we'll be able to bring that accessibility with us when we project them into other devices.
Well, I think Allison was really kind of making that point earlier as well, is that if she can have an accessible home operation on her phone, or accessible healthcare on her phone, then by the very fact that the phone itself is accessible from the ground up, makes it much more likely that those new items that are coming along are also going to be accessible. And that's something that I would love to see incorporated. You know, I'd love to see Amazon make the Kindle completely accessible. They've moved in that direction and made it somewhat accessible to a blind person, at least some models of the Kindle. But wouldn't it be great if the Kindle store was also accessible on the Kindle, things like that? And that's the difference between kind of bolting it on versus building it in, I think.
Yeah, and your priority maybe shouldn't be to have four cameras and a faux 3D effect, but to have a phone that is incredibly accessible.
Yeah, exactly. Allison, anything you didn't have a chance to ask or to mention that you would like to add at this point?
Nothing I could think of at the moment. Renee, thank you so much for coming on. This has been delightful.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
It has been most enjoyable, and I would encourage everyone to check out the iMore Disability Forums either on the web or through the apps, and to get in there and participate and add your own voice to this whole accessibility moving forward idea. And I think it's a great idea if you can let us all know what you're doing that's unique and interesting regarding accessibility. So thank you for not only coming on here, Renee, but for providing a vehicle for people to do that on iMore.com. It's very cool what you're doing, and I totally applaud you for it.
Thank you. It really is the very least we could do.
Allison, if people want to comment or send us in questions or thoughts about this show, how would they go about doing that?
They can feel free to send an email to techdoctor@dr-carter.com, and I hope you will, folks.
I'm so glad you can remember that address, because I can never quite spit it out somehow.
You know, I freeze up about a second before trying to remember it, like, oh my God, what is it?
Well, you did good. All right, folks, we'll be back before long with something else here on the Tech Doctor podcast. But for now, this is Robert the Tech Doctor saying so long.
And this is Allison Hartley saying bye, everyone.